The year is 1885. Your name is Catherine Walker. You're 23 years old. You have lived in Philadelphia your entire life. Recently, you haven't been well, or at least your husband Trevor tells you so. He'd caught you crying over the piano and in bed last night. He says the liquor bottles have been emptying faster, and he finds it strange the way you sit on the riverbank and watch the water flow until sunset. You caught him once in the drawing room, hunched over a desk with your journals and papers splayed across it, and there was a dreadful look in his eye. For a moment, it looked like anger. For a moment, you thought he might hit you, but then you stepped closer and the anger melted away into concern, into pity. A colleague of Trevor's gave him the name of a doctor. You were lying in bed in a place called Martha's Vineyard. The doctor told Trevor that the sea air would be good for you. But you've never seen the sea since you got here. You've only seen this room. You only know the sea exists because of the salty scent that rides on the breeze. The room is small. There's a bedside table where the nurses set down food and drink. There's a desk in the corner with no ink, no papers. There is a shelf with no books. There is the bed you lie in. You cannot leave the bed. You cannot leave the room. Trevor didn't tell you how long you would be sent away for. He only kissed you on the forehead and told you to get better soon, my love. You don't know how long you've been gone. There are no clocks in the room, nor any calendars. But there is a tree outside you can see from your window. You know when you arrived that its leaves were crisp summer green. Now they've begun to yellow at the edges. You have not written since the leaves were green. You have not read since the leaves were green. You have not sketched or sewn or played piano. You have not walked. You have not stood. You have not left your bed. You have not spoken since the leaves were green. The doctor walks in with the nurse behind him carrying a tray. Good evening, Miss Walker, he says. He feels your forehead and the pulse on your wrist. He looks at your eyes and inside your mouth. He pokes and prods at you like a doll. He drags over a chair, sits next to you, and begins to write, "You're getting better," he says. He does not ask how you feel. When he leaves, the nurse takes his spot beside you. She sets the tray down on the table, and the smell makes you nauseous. And she looks at you the same way Trevor did when he decided to send you away. Your eyes dart to the window. You pray the leaves are brown already, shriveling and blowing away with the wind. You wiggle your toes under the blankets, praying you still know how. And you use every bit of strength you can gather to keep your tears behind your eyes. Because that is what got you here in the first place, isn't it?
No Rest for the Hysteric, an analysis of The Rest Cure by Caroline Morrison.
Round my Indiana.
What I've just described is The Rest Cure, a popular psychological treatment for mental illness in the late 19th century and early 20th century. Beyond that, it is a prime example of extreme medical malpractice, abusive patients, general disregard and disrespect of the mentally impaired, and an absolutely disgusting display of medical misogyny. Today, I'd like to share with you my analysis of this practice, how it came to be, why it was so popular, and show how many of the sentiments behind it still linger today. In the late 19th century, The Rest Cure was one of the most common treatments for hysteria, particularly among young women in the Western world. The first step was to make arrangements for the patient to be moved away from their home to somewhere unfamiliar and new. Typically, these would be small towns with low elevation, often in river valleys or by the ocean. Beautiful, scenic places, though that wouldn't matter much at all, because upon arrival, the patient would be confined to bed rest from anywhere between 6 weeks to several months in certain cases. It was complete bed rest. Patients were not permitted to leave their beds, to walk, or to go outside. No reading, no writing, no sewing, painting, or other crafts. In many cases, speech was even prohibited. As for food, patients were force-fed a high-caloric diet as their only source of sustenance, designed to keep them lethargic. By modern standards, this treatment is so clearly inhumane, and it leaves one to wonder how it came to be so widely accepted in the first place. The short answer is that it was effective. Though not effective in the sense that it yielded a cure, effective in the sense that it yielded the desired behavior. I think about it this way. In a world where a woman's opinion doesn't matter and is scarcely heard, the threat of this treatment was akin to a threat of torture. It is less that the rest cure cured hysteria, but rather that it scared women into acting the way society thinks they should behave, lest they endure the psychological torture of the rest cure. But the problem? Hysteria had a very fluid definition, and it was nearly impossible to predict how one was expected to behave. Defining hysteria in the context of cultural and historical analysis is a complicated task, mainly because hysteria didn't really refer to one specific condition in the 19th century, but was more of an umbrella term for any number of symptoms, conditions, and ailments. For example, possible symptoms of hysteria included depression, infertility, trouble sleeping, heightened anxiety, social ineptitude, or even an affinity for writing. In essence, any sort of behavior that might make men uncomfortable could be categorized as a symptom of hysteria. In some cases, women were actually experiencing conditions which we now know as PTSD, postpartum depression, panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, depression, and many other mental and neurological disorders. In other cases, the behavior displayed by so-called hysterics was simply the natural reaction to an abusive living situation. No matter the cause, symptoms were almost always maladaptive, meaning they had a significant effect on the daily lives of sufferers, and for a woman, seeking medical help was a gamble. Who knew what the doctor would do to you? At best, you'd be prescribed a tonic or advised to seek a broader social life. At worst, you'd be sentenced to a prison disguised as a bedroom. Though my specific focus for this project has been the field of psychiatry, the medical mistreatment of women was rampant throughout many fields of medicine at the time. Furthermore, general prejudice in the medical treatment of women has been present for the majority of recorded history, dating back to as early as the time of the ancient Greeks. Many ancient cultures held the idea that women were inherently defective and only paid attention to medical issues that had to do with reproductive processes. Though these ideas are dated, they are still rather prevalent in how we view modern medicine. Those who identify as women in the present day are far more likely to have serious illness misdiagnosed or played off as simply caused by stress and treated with a mild pain reliever or antidepressant, rather than being given a full investigation and diagnosis. This is especially evident in diagnosis of chronic pain disorders and cancers. Not only does this ignorance cause significant unnecessary pain, it also causes many otherwise avoidable deaths. History is about more than reading stories, more than memorizing dates and names. History is about understanding the motivations and fears that led people of the past to make the decisions they did, and it is crucial to understand ugly parts of history like this. It is our responsibility in society to know, to understand, to prevent. It is our responsibility to understand that without human intervention, we are doomed to repeat atrocities of the past over and over again. Usually, we don't even notice we're doing it. While the rest cure has been out of use for nearly a century, medical misogyny in psychiatry did not disappear with it. Problematic tactics have simply evolved as our society has advanced. On January 17, 1946, surgeon Walter Freeman performed the first transorbital lobotomy on Sally Ionesco by driving a tool akin to an ice pick through her eye socket and into her skull, severing brain connections. The result? A docile, submissive Sally, unable to focus, learn, or feel anything deeply. A robot housewife with seldom a complaint or opinion. A shell. The procedure became wildly popular, even in minor cases. Many died from complications. 1950. The Soviet Union declares the lobotomy unethical and bans the practice of it. Other world powers begin to follow suit. Though unpopular, lobotomies were performed in the United States well into the 1980s. 1954. Wallace Laboratories introduces meprobamate, the hot new sedative, and it's profitable. Very profitable. Suddenly, the happy pill business is booming. Benzodiazepine hits the market. Then Valium. No one knows the long-term effects of these tranquilizers, but what they do know is that they make the housewives stop complaining, the children quit their tantrums, and life a little bit more tolerable. Doctors are handing them out like candy, and by the 70s, 20% of American women are being prescribed Valium each year. 10% are addicted. Critics nickname the pills emotional aspirin. It takes away the pain for a little while, but it's hardly a cure. 1978. Myrna Dennis had been a longtime patient of her psychiatrist, Dr. T.H. Allison. After 13 years of seeing him, she was beaten, drugged, and raped by him in a Dallas hotel. Afterwards, she was completely abandoned by Dr. Allison and checked herself into a mental hospital. The result? A Myrna more traumatized and broken than she was before her 13 years of treatment. Cases of sexual abuse by mental health professionals became prevalent. Some psychiatrists use sex to hold power over their patients, threatening to have them admitted to hospitals or have custody of their children taken away if they would not comply. Others promised patients that sex could cure their ailments. As we have grown to be a more empathetic and equitable society, significant progress has been made in the field of psychiatry regarding gender bias, both from a clinical and ethical perspective. It is why treatments like the Rescure are absolutely unthinkable today. But this does not mean problems do not still linger. Significant gender-based bias has been observed in diagnostic criteria for psychological disorders for nearly 50 years, especially in personality disorders. It is a well-known fact in the field that most diagnostic criteria are based on outdated studies which observed only the behavior of men. It is a well-known fact in the field that personality disorders can display themselves in vastly different ways depending on gender. And yet there has been little significant change to account for these known biases. Now, in the midst of an American mental health crisis, we must look at our past mistakes and learn from them. We must listen to the voices of those who are oppressed. The fight for gender equality in America is not over. Inequality can be sneaky, hiding deep down in the systems we are reliant on.